Welcome to Enabled, the weekly program about people just like you who are dealing with issues of vision loss. The program is designed to encourage you through news you can use, inspirational stories, and interviews. I'm Nancy Zimmer, your host for Enabled. Thank you for joining me. Politicians and journalists. Now that certainly is an odd couple considering our current situation. In this program, I have discovered common ground, and that is blindness. You will hear about a blind journalist and her interview with a blind politician. And you'll also hear about a man who was a North American political correspondent for BBC. The first article is from the Lighthouse for the Blind in San Francisco, and it's dated March of 2016. The headline reads, Stump Speech, a blind journalist talks with a blind politician. And that blind journalist who wrote this article is Michelle Hackman. She starts out by saying, Cyrus Habib is a regular politician. Even if you're a political junkie, you'd be forgiven for not knowing his name. He is a first-term state senator in Washington State, albeit one who has already made his way into the party's leadership. He's also a declared candidate in the race for lieutenant governor, but for all intents and purposes, that is a local office afforded none of the national stature of the governorship. If you have heard of Cyrus, though, chances are you know him as the whip-smart, Yale-educated, Rhodes Scholarship-winning politician who, and this was probably the subject of the story you read, who is also blind. Most stories about him see his accomplishments overshadowed by vague or nonsensical headlines such as Blind Lawyer Reflects Biography in Policy, or in more than one publication, From Braille to Yale. Never mind that he's also the first Iranian-American to hold state senatorial office, and far from the first blind person in politics. For years, Cyrus Habib has seen his name in print, always chased by the word blind. I have heard of Cyrus, maybe because I'm a political journalist who was also blind, which means he sits right at the nexus of everything I care about. Or perhaps that's just what the five or so people who have emailed me articles about him recently must have figured. One such confidant, whose casual musings have more than once inspired the direction of my stories, suggested offhand that I try to write something about Cyrus. A quote, I'd love to write about him, I told my friend, but I want to stay away from the blind guy becomes politician type of narrative, and I don't know him well enough to pick out a different storyline. I get into this field to write about high-stakes, messy minefield that's national politics, and I couldn't bear to think that anything I might write would join the slow march of glowing triumph over adversity headlines that are parading across the screen whenever I search for Cyrus Habib's name. Still, I'm guilty. I read those articles, at least six of them. While none stood out as egregious, something about the article's tone gnawed at me. There was an eerie quality to them, all containing the same anecdotes relayed in unnervingly similar diction. It seemed obvious that Cyrus had developed a cheery politician's vocabulary around his disability. Rather than portray annoyance, the most unpolitician-like of dispositions, he seemed eager to sell his story in patient, canned detail to journalists who questioned him about it. Underneath it all, I thought I detected bullshit. How could a Yale law-educated legislator enjoy molding his own public identity so explicitly around his blindness? Did he not want, even if privately, to focus attention on the record-shattering money he was raising or the polls that he was topping? Did he not feel somehow minimized? With a mix of curiosity and distaste, I performed one more search for his phone number. It's hard to say why Cyrus's apparent cheery embrace of his blindness bothered me so. On the one hand, blind people, especially the small subset of us interested in politics, should laud one another for our public successes or any public display of competency that disarms the public of their preoccupation and makes life a little easier on us all. I don't deny that those sorts of successes, like being elected to public office, deserve some level of news coverage. At the same time, I desperately want a career for myself that is successful on its own terms, neither dependent on my blindness nor in spite of it. I used to fantasize about becoming one of my generation's great political reporters, one of those Bob Woodwards or Tim Russert types, minus the cigars, of course. Then after reading my story in the paper, a woman would turn to her husband and say, "That Michelle Hackman, did you know she's also blind?" It would be an interesting little fact, but largely beside the point. As the same friend once aptly put it, "You want to be a journalist? Hold the adjective." The problem is pretty much no one else is ready to hold the adjective. This fantasy of success unrelated to and not as a factor of my blindness, this fantasy was first shattered in the summer of 2014 while I was working as an intern at the Wall Street Journal's Washington Bureau. As part of my job, I made regular trips to the U.S. Capitol. To me, the work was rockstar cool, but nevertheless, distinctly intern-like. I chased the stories that were intended inserts buried in the paper. I sat in on committee hearings and press conferences, only to supply quotes to senior reporters. I spent so much time fantasizing about scaling the journalistic ladder, of becoming the person that other interns would come to and ask for help, it never registered that someone else might think I had already made it. Keep in mind that I'm talking about our nation's capital, where identity politics can often dictate business. It's still news whenever a black man is elected to the Senate, although black men were senators dating way back to Reconstruction era. I can name plenty of disabled journalists who came before me, but of course, most people likely can't. I shouldn't have been surprised then when the Washington Post came calling. Their media correspondent, Paul Farhi, had heard of a young blind woman traipsing around the Capitol trying to make her name as a reporter. To him, that was story enough. Farhi sent me a note on Facebook, but his message landed in my spam folder. I actually only found it, along with several persistent follow-up notes, in the process of writing this account. Eager for a reply, he then rallied my boss, who promptly caught me typing at my desk. I could tell that my boss, a sanguine, even-handed man, was jumping out of his skin for me to agree to this profile. The story, he suggested, would chronicle just how I pulled off my reporting. But it wouldn't rely on stereotypes, he assured me. Farhi had a reputation for fairness, and it would appear on the paper's front page. A quote, "He thinks you're pretty remarkable," he offered as a concluding thought. I said nothing. How do you tell the Washington Post that they've got it all wrong, that a handful of blind journalists had come before you, and you're in it for the substantive accomplishments, not for the overcoming adversity-style frame? That maybe someday you might be remarkable, but right then you felt like the furthest thing from it. When I finally decided to call Cyrus Habib, I felt like I was doing the unthinkable. I was going to write just the story I had sworn to my friend that I would never author. I wanted to write satire of the remarkability narrative, the one that had elevated Cyrus's profile to begin with, using his own words. I wanted to vent that Cyrus was definitively not breaking new ground when numerous blind politicians, including one from his own state of Washington, had trodden there before him. I wanted to ask him, what do we need to do to get to the point where a story like this, a blind author writing about a blind politician for the sole reason that he's blind, does not need to be written? But when I finally got a hold of Cyrus on the phone, he's a busy guy, it turns out, he shared none of my cynicism. I brought up the empathetic pangs of annoyance that I'd been feeling reading his many interviews, but he connected with none of them. Cyrus allows his blindness to remain the subject of any conversation as long as it's needed, he said. When he goes out for campaign events, he told me, people pepper him with the most basic questions about his everyday life, like how he gets around, how he uses a computer. This is something with which all blind people are familiar. Sometimes, when he's walking alone down a street, people will still seize his arm to direct him or ask him whether he knows where he's going. That question posed to me will invoke a range of reactions, anywhere from a faux polite, "Yes, thanks so much," to a dirty look or ostentatious flourish of my phone. "Look, I'm a gainfully employed woman. Please leave me be." I would never have the composure to react like Cyrus did, who told me he's grateful for the help, as any annoyance he might have felt is far outweighed by the real danger he sometimes faces. Here's a quote. "I've been on my phone and have actually walked into traffic," he said, "just like the rest of us." The annoyance I was expecting him to express amounted to umbrage taking or choosing to be offended at actions others didn't intend as offensive. Here's a quote from him. "I don't think any of it is about a stereotype," he said. "I think it's about a lack of information." That's an information gap that, as a public figure, he feels an obligation to fill. While running for president back in 2012, Cyrus reminded me, Mitt Romney delivered a speech laying out the basic tenets of Mormonism. President Obama, during the 2009 presidential campaign, gave a similar speech about the significance of his race. Here's a quote. "There's always some number of biographical stories that happen when you first enter into politics," he said. And as Cyrus spoke, I fell into momentary reverie, going back to a scene several weeks prior when I had first read about him. I was playing Uno with my cousin's three boys, all under the age of 10. They loved playing with my set of Uno cards in particular because they had Braille letters and numbers clustered at the top left corner of each card. They had all read about Helen Keller in school, but none had ever seen Braille before. I was already on edge playing Uno with three infamous cheaters. In the middle of the game, one of them grabbed my hand and started picking out each card, one by one. "What does this one say?" he asked me, handing me a yellow six. I told him. He pulled out a second and demanded I identify it. Then I snapped, "I don't like it when you test me like that," I scolded. My own tone surprised me, but I likely would have forgotten the event entirely if the boy's mother, my cousin, hadn't overheard. She said, "They just don't understand it, Michelle. They want to learn it from you." Well, my mind then drifted back to the Post reporter. I had turned him away in the righteous hope that my steadfast refusal to be identified as a blind journalist would somehow win me some measure of respect. I had rejected immediate prominence for a slow climb toward recognition. I still shudder to think that someone else's story written about me would eclipse anything if I myself might write. But in the year and a half since then, every time a new friend or colleague wants to know how I type or whether I commute alone, I wonder, would it not have been better for them to read about me in the newspaper? For them to learn exactly how a blind woman uses her computer and goes out to report and, at the end of the day, does the same job that they do. That way, when we meet, those curiosities wouldn't have to hang over our conversations. Well, I snap back to reality, to Cyrus's calm voice on the other end of the line. He was saying that goes away once you start to do substantive things in office. Then they want to talk about, "Why did you raise my taxes?" Well, I don't believe Cyrus's willingness to explain his blindness is totally altruistic, quite the contrary. One of the first ads he aired back in 2012 during a race for the State House seat opens with the line, "I lost my eyesight to cancer at the age of 8, and that taught me the importance of hard work and creative solutions." That line, while true, allows him to instantly parlay his disability into a list of clear policy priorities. Some of that same self-promotional drive is what is at work in the many interviews I read. Cyrus appears to have taken the gamble that, in talking about his blindness, he would educate people while also raising his profile beyond the scope of the average state-level politician. In his case, the gamble paid off. Near the end of our interview, I asked him about this point, a hint of annoyance doubtless audible in my voice. I recounted the story of the persistent Washington Post reporter, the one who had found me quote-unquote remarkable. Farhi, by the way, ultimately never ended up publishing that story. And that was for the best, I told Cyrus. She said, at least I'll let someone write about me once I've accomplished something. But I needed to know, would he have done the story? He said 100% yes. What part of the story is not going to say that I was a Rhodes Scholar or a state senator? Or that I went to Yale Law School? There's no blind Rhodes Scholar stereotype. By writing the story, they've recognized that you're enough of an anomaly. And though I disagreed with Cyrus, and I still do, his words rang with such self-love that I was momentarily taken aback. Sure, maybe he was using blindness as a competitive advantage, but there was an emotional nakedness, a radical self-acceptance, too, that I envied. It requires a sort of comfort in your own skin to allow people to stare at you, to be fascinated by your blindness, to indulge in their curiosity without making you feel self-conscious. I clearly had not reached that point when I first came to Washington, and I haven't come as far as Cyrus in his first campaign for office. But by living through Cyrus's words, by transcribing them onto this page alongside of my own for all of you to read and hear, I can only hope that I'm on my way. Michelle Hackman is a politics reporter at a website called Vox.com, and she was talking about Cyrus Habib. He is, at least in 2006, he was a state senator in Washington State. So next, we come to a person called Gary O'Donohue. The headline, this comes from the www.independent.co.uk. It comes from the UK. Gary O'Donohue, and the headline reads, "My mother once thought of killing us both. Life was so hard." The only blind broadcast journalist in Britain talks to Matthew Bell, and he is once again from the Independent news source in the UK. On Gary O'Donohue's first day at the BBC, he was asked to bungee jump off the Chelsea Bridge. Well, that was 18 years ago. As a junior reporter on the Today program on the BBC, now a highly regarded political correspondent, O'Donohue doubts if a modern-day producer would dare ask the same of a blind person. Disabled people can be victims of our risk-averse culture. When I joined the BBC, I went to Macedonia during the Kosovo War. Although there was all sorts of training, I am not sure it would be quite so easy now. This was a quote from Gary O'Donohue. The article continues, the BBC, where he has spent his entire career, first at the Today Show and then on the World Service, the BBC prides itself on its diversity and anti-discrimination policies. But O'Donohue is the only blind broadcast journalist in the country. Already a familiar voice on radio, he is now presenting more for the TV news, as well as on the internet. Even for a sighted journalist, working across three platforms can be demanding, but O'Donohue is unfazed. He said, "The technology has come on a lot in the past 15 years. I used to have to beg researchers to read cuttings onto tape before going home to listen to them. I would always be half a day behind everyone else." Now he uses a piece of software on his laptop that interprets his emails and text documents and reads them aloud in a synthetic voice. Inevitably, there are still obstacles, such as photographs of text, PD files that cannot be read, for example, but the internet has transformed O'Donohue's working practices. He said, "When I started out, press releases would come in on the fax machine, which is completely useless. I'm quite bullish about it now when bits of paper are handed out. Number 10 did it the other day, and I just said, 'I'm sorry, but I can't read this.' They thought about it for a couple of minutes, and then they emailed it to me instead." O'Donohue was born partially sighted, but had lost the use of both his eyes by the time he was 8. Although mild-mannered and resolutely upbeat, he has had to fight his corner. Last year, he was awarded a five-figure payout after complaining that he had been unfairly discriminated against when a producer gave one of his stories to another correspondent to present on the 10 o'clock news. He declines to discuss that episode when we meet, but speaks passionately on the underrepresentation of disabled workers in the media. Here's a quote, "There aren't many, and there should be more. There is 66% unemployment among blind people of working age. It's an absurd figure." Should quotas be set? No, there is no interest in over-promoting people who aren't up to it. That would be the worst possible thing you can do. But when you come across them, then for goodness sakes, use them. And the article continues by saying one barrier to getting more disabled people into the workplace is a lack of confidence. And O'Donohue recognizes that his education played a large part in shaping his "yes, we can" spirit. He comes, he says, from quite a working class background. But he was sent to a special boarding school for blind children in Worcester and was the first person in his family to go to university, studying philosophy and modern languages at Oxford. Here's a quote, "The school was amazing. We did all sorts of things. It would not countenance the idea that things weren't possible." He's talking about his boarding school for blind children at this point. He said they would not undertake the idea that things weren't possible. Football, which they mean soccer, football, ballroom dancing, we even went skiing. And by the way, O'Donohue actually played football for the England blind team. It's a very violent game. He continues by saying they also taught us to drive. They would take us to a disused airfield in dual control cars. It's something you couldn't get away with these days, 4 blind kids and an instructor in a car charging around an airfield. O'Donohue's father was a semi-professional footballer before becoming a taxi driver, and his mother taught ballroom dancing before she was married. So, quote, she had quite a hard time of it when I was young, because in those days there was not a lot of support for parents who had disabled or blind children. You were expected to reinvent the wheel yourself the whole time. A couple of years ago, she taught me that when things got really bad, she thought seriously of killing us both. I think it's really a brave thing to say to your offspring. I think that was quite a dark time. Now, at the age of 40, O'Donohue divides his time between a small London flat and Yorkshire, where he lives with his partner, Sarah Luthwaite, and their 7-year-old daughter, Lucy. During his career, he has covered stories in Africa, Asia, Europe, and the U.S., but he seems most at home in Westminster, where he has been stationed since 2004. When we meet, he is about to do a pre-record ahead of time before presenting at the Radio 4 show, that's the title of the radio show, Radio 4 show called The World This Weekend, for the first time, which he hopes to do more of. The thing about disability is that in many ways it makes life difficult, but it can also be an asset if it makes you stand out a bit. There are people who are prepared to take a chance with me. This is the job that I wanted for quite a long time, and now I've got it. It's up to me to make the best of it. And this was once again from the independent news source in the UK. Now we have a more updated preview of his life. This is a brief overview, a current overview from Wikipedia. Gary O'Donohue is English journalist, currently working for the BBC News in Washington, D.C., as their chief North American political correspondent. His early life, as we just mentioned, was born in Norfolk, England. His father was a semi-professional football player who also worked as a taxi driver. His mother taught ballroom dancing. O'Donohue was born partially sighted but went totally blind by the time he was 8. He was educated at Worcester College for the Blind, and that's that specialized school that he mentioned where they went driving cars in the parking lot. At that time, it was a boys' boarding school, though it has since merged with a similar girls' school. While in school, he played blind football for England. O'Donohue then attended Christ Church at Oxford University, where he studied philosophy and modern languages. In a recap of his career, he was given work-study experience at the BBC as his first job. He was working for a Braille production department where he was asked to operate the photocopier. O'Donohue joined the BBC upon graduation, becoming a junior reporter on BBC's Radio 4 Today program. At one time, he was asked to bungee jump off Chelsea Bridge. During his career, he has covered stories for BBC News in Africa, Asia, Europe, and the U.S. In 2004, O'Donohue became a political correspondent based at Westminster, reporting across the media, radio, television, and the Internet. From October 2011, O'Donohue was the chief political correspondent for BBC Radio 4, primarily reporting for the Today and the PM programs. In 2007, he broke the news that the UK Prime Minister Gordon Brown was returning from early from holiday to deal with an outbreak of foot and mouth disease. However, BBC News at 10 handed the story over to June Kelly to present. This act in 2008 resulted in an out-of-court five-figure payment to O'Donohue on grounds of disability discrimination. And then, bringing you up to the present, at the 2014 BBC News Festival, it was revealed that O'Donohue would be moving to Washington, D.C. He is now the chief North American political correspondent for BBC News. Since then, he has covered U.S. politics all the way up to and including the Donald Trump White House. Between assignments, in summer of 2014, he toured UK universities, telling journalism students about his time in the business so far. Well, we started out the program talking about the odd couple, politicians and journalists, so to end today's program, I have a quote for you from that very memorable 1970s TV show. Oscar Madison is looking into the refrigerator, and he says, "Do you want brown juice or orange juice?" His co-star, Felix Unger, responds with a question, "What's the difference?" Oscar answers, "3 weeks." Well, they certainly were an odd couple, weren't they? Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great week. You've been listening to Enabled, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. Our technical director is Maureen Rich, and I'm Nancy Zimmer. I hope you'll join me again next week for more updates and information and encouraging stories. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can listen to it at our website, wxxi.org.